we are convening this particular portfolio committee with the Department of Higher Education and Training, and on our agenda, we will be getting the briefing from the department on its plans to increase the enrollment rate, the graduate output, as well as FET colleges and related matters. We received, I think, two apologies. One from Member Kubai, which is currently in the Eastern Cape. She was here yesterday. Also from, I think, Mr. Buenamo. It's not related to, is there still illness in the family? Is it? Okay. I think what we'll do is possibly a card on behalf of the committee to Mr. Buenamo and his family. Is there any other apology that I do not know about? None. So members, that's the agenda. Let me just, by way of introduction, ask the members, and we'll start on my left-hand side, just to introduce ourselves. We do have the department here. We do have a brand new Director General, and also welcome, DG.
Thanks.
You're new, but you're also relatively new into the space, as a collective. So it seems to me both Parliament for Higher Education and Training, as well as the department, we are starting anew. And I think that's where the opportunities, in a sense, rest. So I thought before we get it delved into our work, it's going to be important for department to just know who's our members, for the members to know the responsibilities of each of our departmental officials here. I'm Marius Fransman, and I'm chairing this committee. Zuraina?
I'm Zuraina van der Meulen, and I'm the PA to Mr. Fransman. I'm Zuraina van der Meulen, and I'm the PA to Mr. Fransman.
Good morning, members of the department and honorable members. My name is Lepeto. I'm a member of this committee.
I'm
Nomalunga Lugina, the member of this portfolio committee.
I'm Silence Makubela, the member as well.
I'm Boma James, I'm a member of this committee.
Good morning, I'm Nolita Vubuza, I'm a member of the committee.
Sibidi Mangena, I'm a member of the committee.
Good morning, I'm
Marcel Walter,
I'm a member. Thank you.
Kirsty Menon, Department of Higher Education and Training.
Menon. And just give us an idea of your responsibility there.
Chief Director, Academic Planning and Management.
Kim Evenchwell, Department of Education, Deputy Director General, Further Education and Training.
I don't think my button. Oh, there it is. Mary Metcalf, DG Higher Education and Training.
Anna Lekadinge, Committee Secretary.
Okay, thank you. Members, let me indicate then that we. You can give it back, Lekhetcha. Let me indicate that we've had last week, Director General, I think analysis on the National Student Financial Aid Scheme, and I am going to ask the Secretary of the Committee to make sure that you are receiving the year's diary. So that will do by the end of today, before the end of the day one, two. But essentially what we've done, in the first few months, we've agreed that there would be a lot of briefings, but that we would want to zoom in on certain particularities. And the committee, understanding our legislative responsibility, but also zooming in on very particular areas, and one of those that is the student financial support, both obviously at the higher end. We've agreed that the question about access and transformation is a real issue for us, and we will be looking more deeper into that. We've taken note of the debates around language and all those related issues, but we did not yet have a focused discussion on that, but we've received the report on social cohesion and transformation. We also had a discussion, I think a few weeks ago, with the South African Quality Assurance, where we've reflected on a concern for us is the RPL, recognition of prior learning. And I'm just raising this, and it's not necessary for debate today, but it's something that we've agreed that we want the department to come and explain. We have a view, and it's subject for correction. Our view is that RPL in this country is still quite ad hoc being implemented, that if there's an institution or a drive-in institution that want to push it, then it's there, but it's not as if it's institutionalized in a very real way. We also have a view that there is that it possibly verges on the question of unfunded mandate in a sense, and meaning that there's not a engineered funding regime for RPL. So that is, and I'm saying subject to correction. So those were some of the presentations that we had, and we were a bit concerned about that. We also asked that the secretary of the committee at the appropriate time inform the department that we are concerned about the unregistered colleges in this country and the negative implication on the quality of education, and people that most probably walk around with certificates, working class people. So it's to do with unregistered colleges and not appropriate a certification, and that our perspective is that there's no, and I'm saying our perspective because we've discussed it now, possibly it's a wrong perspective because there's most probably good answers to all of that, but we feel that it's still reactive. So if somebody in the community makes a call and then it's being registered, but we do not necessarily see a proactive intervention on that matter. The question about, we had a presentation of the Development Bank of South Africa not so long ago in the month of August around the roadmap to education, and we broadly agree that there is a serious challenge on the quality of our education. We understand that the historical realities around that. And then we agreed in that committee meeting that we most probably in partnership with DBSA, and I want to suggest in partnership with the department, as Parliament, have a discussion on a roadmap to skills development in this country, so that we bring into the center of the ordinary people of South Africa. The Minister has raised a concern about the age 16 to 24 years old and largely unemployable and unemployed, and that we need a reskilling strategy, a post-schooling process, and we thought that if we as Parliament could be a creative platform for people to engage on skills development in every small community in this country then, and our constituencies, etc., then that be, and the stuff that I've indicated is just to give you some idea of the debates that has occurred, and that's not all the stuff. We hope to do a visit to Stellenbosch University in the month of October. We will be visiting Guyana, I think, early October, and on request of the chief whip that we possibly should have delayed, not for September there. So those are some of the things. We are concerned about the 44% that is not graduating in terms of the type of financial support that we're giving. and proof of the right fathers are. So in that spirit, we then said it's best, after we've received all of these presentations, that we start building in with the department. We also felt it important because we knew the department is putting itself together. It's a new department, and that's why we did not insist that at every briefing we need to have the department, so that we analyze and then at the appropriate time bring you in. So we are sensitive to the fact that it's a brand new portfolio, not necessarily for yourself, but also as an institution. With that, I would want then to hand over to yourself to lead us into this presentation. I'm noting your hand. Back to you.
If I could just add the fact that a variety of bodies have indicated to us that the data that's used for planning is out of date. And let me just highlight some key ones. SAQUA says that, told us that the national learner research data is 3 years out of date. As a point, there is, just quoting from my own minutes, talking about the lack of information management, and that was a grave issue. And this committee was very concerned about the impact of incorrect data on government funding in higher education and training. There's a further point about the fact that we have been told that we do not know how many professionals there are registered in this country. And so there's a general concern about data, its accuracy and its timeliness, and how crucial, especially in the light of the Green Paper that was released yesterday by the Minister of National Planning, is that any planning requires robust data. And so there's an issue about that. I just wanted to raise that.
Any other matter from the members? Just things that you think we... Because it's also just to bring the department on par with some of the issues that we've discussed over the last month. Any other matter? Okay. I think to understand the point around data, our view is that there's too many surveys, and it doesn't drill down qualitatively into the detail. One of my concerns are that we've asked all the relevant bodies around, give us a list, and it wasn't give us the list to say, but it was to understand that if we are pumping in with 2 billion rand into education into student financial support, and if you have a 40% dropout rate, where's that 40%? Who are they? Why did they drop out? Was it because of this what do you call it, the slice, top slicing, that they had to drop out and therefore couldn't continue in the second year? And if we have given a full bursary, most probably that aspirant young person from Eastern Cape rural village would have continued with the engineering studies or the doctorate, the medical studies. So it is, that's the issue for us. And if they have dropped out, where are they currently? And those that have gone through the system in terms of graduating, are they servicing our nation or are they servicing Canada? I do know of one village in Canada that has 7,000 to 8,000 people. All the doctors are from South Africa in that particular village. So it is, and
Northern Saskatchewan, Chair. It's very cold there.
Very cold. So it is. It's one way one are starting to say, how do we understand the depth, and that's the analysis point that we're interested in. But over to Director General, welcome, and everything of the best with a bright portfolio and with all its challenges. So over to you.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Thank you for the welcome. As you've indicated, this is my first meeting with the committee, and I'm looking forward to working with the committee and probably learning together with the committee. We've come prepared to brief you on our plans in terms of increasing graduate output, increasing access. You have raised several matters that perhaps you might want us to quickly deal with, and if I can refer to them. The issue of a skills roadmap, I think we would welcome a discussion on skills. I would be happy, I think, to return to the committee, possibly to give an overview of where we're beginning to understand work needs to be done. In terms of NSFAS, it may be that Ms. Menon will give a quick response, but it may be something that you wish to return to. In terms of the issue of unregistered colleges, I think I'll ask Ms. Vingewald to give a quick response to that, but again, if there's something on which you would like a more detailed briefing, perhaps we should return to that. Matters to do with dropout and retention of graduates from the country will, to some extent, be handled in the presentations today. The issue of data, I think that we need to get a more detailed report of the concerns of the committee and then perhaps return with detailed information. But I will ask both Ms. Vingewald and Ms. Menon to, in their presentations, indicate the source of the data, because it will not be the same as the National Learner Database, to my understanding. So if you're happy with quick responses now to those questions, would you like us to proceed with replies and then we can go into the substance of the presentation?
Chair, the FET College and the registered colleges, privates, what we would like to do is to make a detailed presentation, but tomorrow I'll get you a status report. It's a much under-reported sector, but it is very carefully managed by a director, Dr. Buthelezi. In 2006, we called for the first time on private equity colleges to register with the Department of Education and be accredited with Umalusi. Now, the colleges that we accredit and register are those that offer full qualifications. Anybody that offers a short course, we don't register. 850 colleges have applied for registration. 150 of those we found didn't offer full qualifications and didn't need to register, and so they've come off of that. We've now made a determination on the 700 of them. Now, 108 we have not made a determination on. That means we're waiting for their health and safety certificate. We're waiting for Umalusi to accredit them. But, Chair, what we do have now is that we have a register of colleges that have been registered and accredited by ourselves and Umalusi, and those who've been rejected. Now, because there are students in those colleges that we have declined registration for one or other reasons, no financial surety, health and safety issues, non-accreditation of their qualification, we give them between 8 and 12 months to phase out that qualification. Because if there's students inside, we can't say to them, stop immediately. So, for example, at the end of this year, December 2009, we have in the order of 300 colleges who should be closing down the offering of particular qualifications unless they have the right to appeal to Minister Nzimande. But we have now very recently, to take it more seriously, we have now recently engaged the security services, because we cannot, without the support of SAPS and the NIA, close down those colleges. So we now make it very clear to students, if you go to a private college, look on the front, and if you want to know from us what the registration number is and what that certificate looks like, they must be sure that when they register at a college, and Chair, if you can help us to get that message, because you're quite right, the very poorest of our people don't know about looking for the registration certificate. But Chair, let me stop there and say that we will give you a detailed report. We can also give you the names of all those colleges that have been approved and those that have been declined. But just to be a little bit careful about those who have been declined, they do have between now and the end of 2010 to phase out the offering of the college. But of course they could also improve their facilities or their quality, and then Minister Nzimande would review that decision.
So we can have that broken down for province, for example.
Sure.
That would be great. Okay, cool.
Mm.
Thank you.
Just to comment on the NSFAS, the National Student Financial Aid Scheme has a ministerial committee with a specific set of terms of reference to review financial aid. And one of the aspects that we have picked up is the relationship between affordability as well as academic support at institutions whether our students who require financial aid also need a kind of a pastoral model within the institutions in order to ensure that they have sufficient social and cultural capital in order to academically succeed within our higher education institutions. This is a matter, of course, that the committee is still currently working on, and we have and would like the opportunity at a later stage, because we've only been in operation since July, and present our report to the minister at the end of this year. But we would like at the later stage to provide the portfolio committee with a briefing on these issues. But just to talk about the tracking system, what we do have at the moment is that the Higher Education Management Information System has a flag against students who have National Student Financial Aid Scheme support, either bursaries or loans. And through this system, we can trace where students, whether they are transferring institutions, whether they are moving courses or shifting programs or dropping out. What it doesn't tell us, of course, is what happens to them after they leave a higher education institution. And that, of course, is a weakness in the system.
Gigi, just on the issue that you've raised, you started off with the skills roadmap that is follow-up. I, in fact, would want to suggest, because we wanted the students to members to remember that one of the outstanding items out of the whole National Student Financial Aid Scheme was a request by committee members that we at least need to have the student representatives to come and brief us. Because we've done everything. We've done the department, we've done NSFAS, we've done Higher Education South Africa, we've tried the students, and we could not get them on that particular day. I think you then communicated the availability is for the 23rd, not for next week. So I do hope that we will be able to have a focused discussion on skills and the roadmap and skills development for next week's meeting.
Chairperson, 2 weeks ago we held a consultative meeting from an initiative from the department with the South African Union, SAS, and they have submitted a detailed submission to the ministerial committee, which is quite detailed in addressing concerns that students have with the National Student Financial Aid Schemes, and they have made some quite valuable recommendations as to what, you know, areas that the committee should focus on.
No, thanks a lot. Gigi, then over to today's presentation.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. We have two PowerPoint presentations, copies of which have been distributed to the committee. We are going to begin with a presentation by Ms. Lindewald, who's the DDG for Further Education and Training, on the FET colleges. And I'll hand over to her.
Thanks,
Gigi.
This PowerPoint presentation is based on the national plan for FET colleges. That should have been distributed as well. And I urge members to read Chapter 5, which is about access to FET colleges, because PowerPoint presentations can't begin to provide the conceptual and intellectual argument that we make in the plan. In this presentation, we're going to look at the particular question you asked us, Chair. How do we increase access to FET colleges? How do we increase success? And we start by looking at the demand, huge demand in this country, and I'll explain why there's such huge demand. The supply, our possibilities for supplying opportunities in FET colleges, and then look at how do we go about increasing access? Because we certainly have enough students that could go into FET colleges, but this is a sector that is very, very young. And by that, I mean while the technical colleges existed, the offering of real vocational education, well-balanced theory and practice, workplace experience,
is very new in this country, and the diversity and the young people to whom it is offered is very different. And so we have to hurry slowly in this expansion. Really. How do we get this to go?
What did you try to read?
There we are. Thank you. We start then by looking at the demand. And you see, while this information is a little out of date, going up to 2006, you can see that almost 100%, and the Democratic government is proud of this, 100% of 17-year-olds are in school. This number has gone up in the last 2 years, and if you look at the very rapid increase in the number of grade 11s and 12s in the schooling system, we say that approximately 87% of learners going up to 17 years of age, which is higher than Britain, are in school or in some kind of institution. But then we have a fairly rapid dropout right down to 30% of 20 to 24-year-olds. So clearly there is a need for this age group to have more opportunities for further education. The second piece of data we want to present is the unemployment rates, and you'll see that while they're going down over in recent years, they remain a great worry, because what recent research commissioned by and paid for by the Ford Foundation and coordinated by CHET indicates not neat children, not in education, not in employment. And it's probably the country's biggest social threat, the number of young people, the thousands, and they estimate 2.7 million in the age group 17 to 24 who are not in education and not in employment. So clearly that's another target market for us. This slide just shows the unemployment rate per province and shows that in Western Cape and Gauteng have lower unemployment rates than, for example, Limpopo and the Eastern Cape and KwaZulu-Natal was the very highest. They are coming down slightly. But to go back to the point about data, this is what makes data very difficult. The increase in the number of people who have come into the country that we've not been able to track. The taking what the Stats South Africa told us this week, going from 4.5 million to 4.8 million people, and the female fertility rate is remaining stable, means that there's a huge in-migration. But this slide starts to show that young people vote with their feet. They know exactly where the employment opportunities are. And our big difficulty in education is to track the fact that from the time they're 16 or 17, they start walking to Gauteng and to the Western Cape because they know of the number of education institutions, the quality of the education institutions, and the possibility for employment. So just while we struggle with the data in our FET colleges to say that when we've done detailed analysis of Tshwane South in Pretoria College, find that 50% of the students at the college come from Limpopo originally, or have come very recently from Limpopo. We also find that even in amongst our matric, there are two provinces where the number, even though we have a gross increase in the number writing matric this year, the numbers in two provinces, Free State and Northern Cape, is down, and in Gauteng and Western Cape is up. So you can see there's a lot of movement in addition to growth. So the argument we make in our national plan is that collectively the data suggests that there's room for increasing enrollment in the FET college system, and there's three pieces of international benchmarks or trends that we use. The one talks about in industrialized countries that 4% of the total population should be in vocational education. Another talks about 6% of the 16 to 24 should be in vocational education. Now that puts in South Africa, that means that we should have between 1 million and 1.6 million people in vocational education. So we've got 470,000. In other words, we've got half of what we should have. And that's when we say we've got to rapidly grow it. To do anything about our economic growth and our social development, we will have to increase this market, not so much in higher education as in this sector. And the third piece of data that we use internationally is that most countries have a pyramid-shaped education system, big schooling system, smaller vocational system, and then a smaller higher education. Ours is an hourglass. Our higher education is almost double our vocational. That's not good for a country's development. And so what we're saying is we have to rapidly increase. We're asking the question, so can we? Can these FET colleges, 230 on site, 50 colleges, can we increase? And what you see, what this graph shows is that we have rapidly increased. And anybody who's run big education institutions will know that you can start to creak and undermine quality or compromise quality if you grow too quickly. What we see here is 1987, there were only 50,000 odd students, mostly white, mostly employed as artisans already, or in apprenticeships. In other words, they just came to the colleges for their theory. After democracy, we start to see an explosion. Unemployed young people can't get into university. They start going to FET colleges. They start enrolling on theory courses, the N1 to N6, that take them nowhere, because they are getting the theory but no practice, because they're not employed. And so what we started to do is to see this explosion going through into 2002. We now literally quadruple from 1997 to 2002 in 6 years. We go up to 400,000. And then the red lights start flashing because our tracking is showing that these kids are just getting theory. They're not getting any practice and they're not getting employed, unless they're lucky to already be employed and they've had the doctorate release system. So you see a slowing of growth now. Short courses, learnerships, the CETA's offering courses in the colleges, and it still continues to grow by 70,000 up to last year, and we've grown a little bit again. But we haven't grown in the formal courses, we've grown in the informal courses. So these trends caused government to say, how can we're seeing a slowing down from 2002, how can we expand? And that was when the recapitalization of the colleges, 1.9 billion rand, was spent in saying we must expand the infrastructure and we must modernize the infrastructure. That was a very successful conditional grant. We spent 99.9% of that grant. And Chair, we would welcome and take you within 3 kilometers of 90 Plain Street or 30 kilometers. We can take you to evidence of outstanding spend of that 1.9 and world-class facilities, computer facilities and engineering facilities. But it's not really enough. And so the question we're going to pose today is, how can we expand even further with from the 470 we've got? Now, Chair, we've been called crazy, mad, lacking in any kind of understanding of the economy. But this is when, in 2007, just before the economic crisis hit South Africa, we had put these figures to Treasury and into the public domain and said, we started, and these are not gross enrollment, these are this NCV, this is what we call our flagship, it's the B degree of the FET colleges, the National Certificate of Vocational. We started with 25,000, we met our targets, it was a new qualification and it did surprise us, we turned in the order of 10,000 students away. In 2008, we had 60,000 enrolled on the NCV, 2009, this year they're 120,000. Now we know that the throughput and pass rate of this has not been good. But we have now projected to going to 800,000 in 2014. We would like to see 1 million children, and it's nice to have that figure, 1 million children in colleges by 2014. The other 200,000 would be on short courses or would be in private colleges. But we would like to grow this, and you can see how steep the growth is. And we have to be very careful that when we encourage young people to come into colleges, we can also somewhat guarantee them a quality education. And so the rest of the presentation says, how are we going to go about supporting that growth? And so we want to knock one myth out of the water. So often in presentations like this, we're told that FET colleges are the second cousin to higher education. Nobody wants to go there. Well, the evidence we have is that's just not so. Every year we turn thousands and thousands of students away. It is a middle-class view, and most of us would not say that this is our first choice for our children. But there is huge demand for young people who can't get into university, especially in Limpopo and Mpumalanga, Eastern Cape. Those colleges turn away thousands of students every year. So that we believe that perception of poor quality in FET colleges, it could be true, and the perception and reality are close, of poor quality in some of our colleges. But in others, there are outstanding examples. So these projections that we've put up, this very ambitious projection of 800,000 by 2014, is based on the recapitalization grant, and we can also take you to colleges that have been beautifully recapitalized, and they stop at 3 o'clock instead of working through to 8 o'clock, as you see other countries do, working weekends, getting rid of holidays, in other words, using infrastructure optimally. So we base it on the recapitalization grant needs to be maximized in the way that we use it. The enrollment growth, which is...
Can I just ask you a question? For that, this 800,000, is it based on, and even your current one, is it based on the precondition that it needs to be, there needs to be the work placement? You remember you said that the lesson learned theory and not work. Is it now that, or is it not necessarily capped at that level yet?
It's very much based on the previous figures I showed of how many unemployed there are and international trends. Our view is that the biggest factor inhibiting this growth would be funds. But we've gone to program funding now, and in 2010, for the first time, we'll use program funding like higher education. That means government can determine and say, we're capping you. We can't afford to take on more than 200,000 students. Our 177, we've put in a bid for 177,000. But that to take in that 177,000 will mean going back to Treasury asking them for 6 billion rand, when currently only 3 billion rand is spent. So you can see, but for us, the cost of leaving these young people unemployed and out of education is a much greater cost to society and to those individuals. Chair, in relation to the workplace, we would say that it would be absolutely ideal, it would be optimal if every student could get workplace experience. Our experience is that South Africa has a very hostile labour market. Even though we say to people, these young people will come and work for free, they will volunteer, all we're asking you to do is to give them 2 or 3 days, 5 days of workplace experience, because it literally seems to turn their opportunities. We are finding it very difficult. Our current 5,000 level fours, if they're in the big urban areas, have got workplace experience. But we've sweated to get them workplace. So, Chair, we
not
think it's unfair to cap it on those
pop-ups. No, I was hoping that's going to be
but just to say that every one of the young people does get extensive, simulated, and workshop experience. It's not quite the same, but it comes quite close. So, Chair, just to say that enrollment growth is great. The other thing we have to do is we cannot have the current dropout rate and failure rate. So these projections are also based on moving to 60 to 80% throughput. And at the moment, it's only on 30% throughput. And then funding available. And now, depending on what happens with higher education, will it be the province or will it be national funding is available? Infrastructure I've touched on and continued recapitalization of infrastructure. We will still have to expand the infrastructure. So our vision is a modern and vibrant coordinated FET college system, but in relation to higher education system, to say that we're in our first baby steps, we really talk about the sector only being 4 or 5 years old and a long way to go. We want to have its own unique identity and legislative space and be responsive to the needs of society. We believe it should be much more responsive to needs of society and economy than higher education. Higher education producing the top end. This sector responding more directly and quickly to the changing needs of the economy. We wanted to provide both niche and comprehensive institutions accessible to youth and adults. We've spoken about expanding access. And again, vocational education and its success depends on partnerships with industry. In order to do this, and again, Chair, again, the vision and the national plan was only approved in 2007, so it's really very early days, but we've got a framework, and I think this is where we are delighted that FET colleges are now part of the higher education landscape. It will give them that opportunity to grow, get the status, and so on. So it's within the framework of what we now call post-secondary education. You can choose between going to a college or to a university. We need to intensify the programs aimed at youth, increasing youth access, improve the quality of the qualifications. We've gone a long way to developing policies and systems, and many of them in their first year of implementation. We have to tweak them as we see implementation. We have to increase. Currently, we only have 4 programs. We'd want to see how we increase approved programs. and perhaps one of the biggest stumbling blocks to quality is the lecturer, the quality of the lectures, and how we improve the number and the quality of the lectures. Two, there's also a misperception that the only thing we offer is the NCV, but no big institution, no sector can operate without a flagship. So like the universities have the B degree, we say the NCV, that is a flagship, that's what we aspire young people to enter for. But there were also, we would want to start to offer some level 5 and 6 higher education programs, especially in areas where there are not higher education institutions. We would want to have public-private partnerships. We're working with the Department of Labor on occupational qualifications, ECD, and adult education training. So, Chair, this sector, quite rightly, because of its good geographic spread, the 230, is a place where there are opportunities for poor and rural people to access post-school education. So we derive our policy goals from Paper 4, and I think there again, coordinated access, quality, diversity, and accountability we would aim for. This is how we want to steer it, through central coordination. And Chair, we now really do have this, now that the colleges have become part of the national higher education training system. We're wanting to define the sector very carefully and start to shape the landscape. And now with the CETAs and higher education, we can start to look, and there's a skills map that you're talking about will help us to say, where are all these institutions and how can we reshape the FET College institutional landscape? We need to improve the infrastructure, enrollment planning. We've been doing this for the last 3 years, and it's been very successful. In every year, the colleges have met the targets that we have set. Of course, the next growth is going to be difficult, but there we would have to make sure that through student recruitment, the bursary funds, ICT, and improving the interface with higher education, those would be the drivers of access. And, Chair, we remain a little bit worried that while we can drive for access and there would be many young people who would desperately want post-school opportunities, we must drive our quality too, otherwise we would be offering them empty qualifications. So whether it's the qualification, the curriculum, the examinations, the lecture training, all of these would be aimed at improving quality at the same time. Chair, I'm going to go on then to the final one. If you read Statistics South Africa's 2008 report, they indicate that the percentage of individuals attending an education institution has risen from 33% to 34%, 3. Now, 1.3% increase sounds like so low. Couldn't you have done better? But if that translates, as it does, 1.3 million, translates into 600,000 young people, you can see how difficult that is to do. And the sector that where we believe the greatest growth should happen is in the FET College sector. But Stats South Africa also tells us that the reason most often cited for not getting an education was lack of financial needs. And so if we are to expand the FET College sector, it would be to expand it to poor people. That is an economic reality. And then the FET College bursaries would be key to providing that opportunity. So our program funding says that the state pays 80%. We've costed the program, the engineering program, 28,000 rand per head. State pays 80%. The student pays 20%. If the learner can't afford the 20%, they need to get a sliding scale bursary. And we started this bursary scheme. It's not an NSFAS bursary scheme. It's called the Department of Education bursary scheme. 2006, we were allocated this, so it was a big race. We wanted to get the first 100 million out in 2007. And 12,000 students benefited. And you'll see up until now, 21,000 students benefited, and we expect this to go up to 50,000. The delay in getting the data through to you is just that NSFAS has to administer these. This bursary is administered by NSFAS. We chose that route because of their experience, their administrative experience, and by and large, they have fulfilled our expectations and really provided good service to the students. These are the conditions. It's only for South African students, those on the NCV programs.
We base the allocations on NCB enrollment, and then the students sit for two tests when they enter the college. They sit for an academic test. All that does is to say on what program are they best suited and what kind of academic support is needed, especially in their language and mathematics. And then we do a poverty means test. And everybody does it, even if you're coming and you're LSM 11. Everybody does the poverty means test. And through their household income, we determine on a scale how much they get. The maximum is 13,000. Some just get 1,000 or 2,000 because they're in a bracket that says that they don't need as much as another set of students. While the Department of Education makes the college allocation, the colleges make the final determination on which students are awarded bursaries, and these are based on financial need and academic performance. We don't provide to those who are repeating the NCV, and the NSFAS processes and pays them. Chen, you will hear some students, and Ms. Menon alluded to the meeting we had with all 50 FET college SRCs. Some of them were worried about why some students got accommodation and travel and others didn't. That's based completely on the means test. And we have to argue that when some of them ask that all students get travel and accommodation, that the pool of money doesn't allow that. And if you give everybody travel and accommodation, you will reduce the number of students who can get a bursary. And there are our responsibilities here. We, the Department of Education, Higher Education and Training, will allocate it based on the poverty of the community in which the college is based, as well as its NCV enrollment. The provincial departments currently monitor and support, although we will take over that function depending on the model that is used for FET colleges. And then the colleges have student support services officer. They have a committee. The SRC sits on that committee, and that they really administer the bursary. Chair, what we've tried to do in this presentation is to show that we have the number of young people in society who desperately need post-secondary education opportunity. We have a young sector that where we're setting up the systems to make sure that they provide a quality system. Expanded infrastructure, a huge increase in funding, and improved lecturer capacity are the binding constraints on that expansion.
Thank you. Okay, thanks. Let's just deal with this presentation first. I think it was a very well-rounded presentation from the department side. I will allow members to raise questions or to make inputs in this regard, but let me just start off by saying, one, that the issue on costing, I've got a very firm view, and it can be a very wrong view, that the moment that EPWP, other departments link up with FET colleges, that there is a costing that is being increased. Differently put, one department tried to make money out of another department. So if somebody from the community go and apply for becoming a plumber at the FET college, then there is a particular price structure. The moment that there's a government department program, say health or anyone else, social development, driving a program to intervene in this poverty map area, wherever it is in this country, then suddenly the cost increased. Now I'm saying I've got a very firm view. That means I've done a little bit of an analysis on it, but I can be wrong. I could have just not had good math in that space. So that's one. I would want to get comments on that. Secondly, so there's a concern for me around the costing structure, because if you are, and the way FET colleges are working in terms of the capacity levels and the concerns around the capacity in-house, because even lecturers there need to be capacitated properly, but a problem so they will get private providers in, mm-hmm. to do all of that at times. And if you start analyzing the link between the private providers and FET colleges, then you, there is a level of disturbance that's uncomfortable. Meaning, if this parliament decided, when the president announced that education and health will be a focal point, are we suddenly seeing a spike in educational cost, which was in any case there before? So what is the opportunity for engagement of a more affordable education process? That's one area that concerns me. Secondly, on the issue of throughput, you said 30%, roughly, because that's quite shocking. What's the reasons for that generally? Now, I got this document. It's a report by Dr. Joy Papier. You saw this one. Done at UWC FET Institute, getting the right learners into the right programs, and an investigation into factors that contributed to the poor performance of FET college learners in 207 to 208, reasons and recommendations. Now, it's interesting that, now this is for the, this was Western Cape. Now, if you actually look at the analysis about FET colleges, Western Cape, Gauteng, in terms of the performance are better. So how much more in other provinces? But quite interesting. They ask particularly revealing why high school respondents' views on who should attend FET college programs. According to principals and teachers, you talked about this thing about perceptions of poor quality, but I think it's an institutional process as well. I think the education system itself, at the level of a school, the teachers. So is there a question around how do we capacitate teachers to best appreciate what FET colleges are all about? Because what they are doing in terms of the study, according to principals and teachers, they should be, meaning those that go to FET colleges, those who are not coping with academic courses, those who know what career they want to do, students not well suited to high school, meaning let's dump them somewhere. Not coping with the demands of the curriculum at high school, dropouts, average learners, etc. So there is, it's not where I'm sitting, only a perception that's being there. Generally, it is an institutionalized perception in a sense. And the question is, what is the programs and even if it's not there now, we are calling that you, in a sense, focus on that. So how do we get, and this is the link possibly between higher education and training and basic education, so how do we capacitate teachers and principals to appreciate the FET college space better? Because if there's a negativity in the way they, for example, identify the scholars in class and say these ones rather go there because they're poor performance, then it becomes a problem. On the issue of migration, which you've touched on, the link, what is the structural link currently between the department, understanding it's a new department, but there was a unit like this, and the National Youth Development Agency, differently put, because the YDA is new, differently put, Umzubombo? Yeah, until recently, and the Youth Commission, is it Youth Commission? Yeah, nationally. So what is the structured relation, not the ad hoc, but the structured relation as we are sitting here, between the department and that institution, which in any case is also busy with a transformational process. I think I've raised the concern around the throughput and what therefore has led to some of the reasoning that led to that. The link between what you are doing and the CETUS, because it didn't come through there, and I understand possibly why, because it's not in your technical domain, but it's a knock-on effect, if you wanted to say anything around that. Can I get a quick, do we want to just add some of the issues related, and then we'll get a response? So, Ms. Shwana?
Thank you, Chairperson.
I was listening at particularly the criteria for offering bursaries, and the way it was said, I think I like the way you were said, but the way it's written is different. I'm checking if there are some hidden clauses here, because we would understand the terminology poverty more than what is written here. Because I went through this thing, you know, I don't know how many times, to check if you are referring to those who are poor to be given a priority. But I don't see it. I see
the means.
What terminology do you use?
The awards are based on financial need.
Financial need?
Yeah. It's
somewhere there.
It's bullet two, yeah.
Okay. I'm sure I missed that one. So that one is covered. But then I'm checking, as learners go to school and they end up in these entities, maybe there are others who understand that. But then what is the use of the education that is offered to an adult who is looking for a job and not necessarily the basic education that's given to an old person just because you cannot read and write? I'm just checking what is it that can be done to ensure that they don't go to school to learn those things that anyway they went to school and failed and they couldn't do it. And I don't know what makes us believe that when you are 40 years you cannot write your name if you fail to do that while you were 5 or 7 years. Well, what can the Department of Education together with us why can't we come up with something? What is it that can be done by the Department of Education to ensure that because we talk of somewhere you mentioned this South Africa being labor unfriendly, if I got it correctly. Wow, if the Department of Education knows that South Africa is labor unfriendly, we need to do something to make it labor friendly. And one of the things that we need to do is to look at these people who cannot continue to be taught things that are not going to provide jobs to them, the skills that we should be talking about. Because you say NCV in bracket, that's one thing that must be unpacked here. What exactly? Only students enrolled or wishing to enroll on NCV program are eligible to apply. And if they apply, are these going to solve the unemployment that we're sitting with? Because the biggest challenge that we're having is to provide jobs, especially the 500 jobs that we have promised. Thank you. 500 what? Yes.
Thank you, Ms. Shina.
Yeah, Chair, mine is short. I just want to know, do we do have these FET colleges that are still under the council? And what is your take on that, just to say, those which are still governed by these councils, the funding processes of them, how do we cater for students under the councils, or are we investigating the point where we'll see all the FET colleges being taken by the Department of Education, and even the data that you're coming up with, are they included, or these councils have that much of an autonomy that they can do whatever? Because I'm looking at the capacitation of the lecturers. Do you include them when you plan around these things? And also the how do the students benefit from everything that you have been talking about? Really, can I just see the link between the councils, those governed by the councils, and what those under the Department of Education as to what is the provision around them?
Are you comfortable if I take the first round? Would you be able to deal with it? Okay. Otherwise, if I can do it four and then you can respond. But I thought possibly there would be similarities in. Would you be comfortable and just okay? Member Lachetcha.
Thank you, Chairperson. You are talking about what the bursaries may cover. Talking about college fees, textbooks, academic services, accommodation, traveling. You are not talking about food, particularly for these rural students from poor, destitute families. My second question is on Nestors. How do you ensure that matriculants know about NSFAS particularly those in rural areas. Because presently, you get this institution in the universities. And these people, the poor, destitute families, don't travel to the universities. They only know about this when they reach the university. Now, how do you make it possible that the matriculants in poor rural areas know about these institutions? I will pause there. Thanks.
Member Makubele?
Thanks. The first relates to this illegal colleges or unscrupulous providers. In the main, who has got the legal responsibility or mandate to pursue their closure or deregistration? Anyway, they happen not to have registered. I think they're just running their own thing. And once we know that they're there, I know now you did refer to some year to go, grace period. But suppose they still operate and proceed, who have got a legal mandate? Is it yourself or who else will be dealing with that? The other, in the aspects that gets covered by the bazaar, you included travel and accommodation. Almost like, other than the food issue, you may be covering almost everything, though there may be shortage of funds in terms of how many people it will cover if we give a full bazaar. But my interest will be, if it's actually happening now, because I thought it's mainly the tuition fees and so on, if it does cover these other aspects, What are the challenges? Do you find NASFAS being able to manage that process administratively, or it's not necessarily within them now, it's within the department? And if there's need to ensure that that capacity resides within NASFAS, is there anything that is being done in the event the review of the current state of affairs within NASFAS? NSFAS does cover everything. Will we have that capacity to administer this kind of thing, particularly where you may need to administer cash to this particular individual?
Thank you very much. I just wanted to say that this is one of the most important things that you're busy with for the nation, and you have our fullest support. And just from a party point of view, that the DA would do its utmost to support you in this, to correct the pyramid or to create the pyramid that you're suggesting. I just had two questions. The one is a question that's sometimes called trading up. That is, if you have, just following the University of California system, if you have a two-year qualification, is it possible to trade up as a third year at an undergraduate university, so that 2 years of FSC takes you into third year at UWC if you're really good. And the reason why I'm asking that is because what I agree with you, what we need is quality at all levels, rather than a hierarchy of quality. And so we want world-class plumbers, we want world-class undergraduates, we want world-class doctorates. And so the ability for a student, a good student, to enter through a community college and end up with a PhD must always be there. That's one question I wanted to ask. The second question is to do with how one goes about ensuring quality of lecturers at this level, and therefore what is the robustness of the performance assessment system that operates at FET level but also at the university as a whole. Because we have tenure as a practice. We have trade unions who protect, for good reason, but who protect the interests of the profession itself. It does not necessarily serve the interests of students. We have that dynamic. And therefore, there's a reluctance often for teachers to be assessed properly. and therefore the quality of the throughput that you offer is hampered by that. So it's those two questions. Thanks.
Thank you, Chair. I feel like it's many questions already. You said something about, and I didn't quite get you, and you identified it as a weakness, actually, to say that something does not tell you what they do after they leave the system, which for me is a gap already. And as I say, you have already said that it's a weakness, because then it speaks to my concern, listening to your presentation, and just wanting to be coherent about what it is that we're doing in further education. What are we doing? I'm just saying, what are we doing? What are we doing, and what is the product that we are offering? And what are the intrinsics and the extrinsics of this product? And what are we doing? What are we fixing? Are we fixing something? Are we supplying a nation with something? Is there a problem out there that you are seeking to solve? What exactly are we doing? In other words, we are increasing access, but for what? What is the big thing out there that we're trying to fix? And if we are doing that, are there any current learnings from the system itself that we then can say we are trying to fix something, and we are learning, and we are trying to fill in a gap or something? So I just don't feel the coherence to say, if you were talking to my people in PEDI, what would they say the presentation was seeking to do? And in my mind, I'm throwing in the issue of us being an activist parliament, and of course I am looking at the EnviroScan, and I'm saying that education is that much important to fix the poverty, but also there are developmental goals in it. So how do you tie with all this thing when you increase this access? So it can be access for its own sake, and I know that the department applies its mind to that. So for me, I just wanted to... And also, there is something we are not talking about. The racial breakdown of this thing. What is the racial breakdown? And what is the targeted intervention? Where are which skills needed? By who? And who is getting them, and who's not getting them? Is it skewed when it happens, or is it not skewed? So what is exactly that? And I'm sure you can appreciate that. The other thing I hear about the responsiveness, and I like the fact that we're responding to the 21st century needs, but are we also able to preempt the needs before we can just respond to them? So that there's no lag between when the problem has occurred and when we're able to fix it. That we could then preempt that and then be on time in terms of fixing that particular problem. Thank you.
Member Mangeva.
Well, I must thank the department for this presentation. I think it was very informative. But some questions still linger. And some of these, of course, forwards, so they overlap with what has been raised by others. Because of the day, there are certain nuances that one will raise. Can you talk about the fact that there's been an injection of funds to recapitalize the colleges? I wonder how far we are, and you said we could go to colleges around Cape Town, and we'll see the progress that is being made. Not so long ago, there was talk of some of the FET colleges, especially in the outlying areas, having antiquated teaching equipment, if any. People using, say, 1950 Chevrolet engine to teach mechanics, or panel beating equipment that, you know, was suitable for the cars of old, and typewriters and stuff like that. There was quite a lot of talk about such a thing. Is that now something of the past? And in terms of experiential training for students, it's a big issue. Even university students have problems with experiential training. I imagine that it will be worse with FET students, and there are many. But some of the employers have been saying whether or not people, students come free of charge, there is still a cost to them, in the sense that you need experienced workers to shepherd them, to guide them in the workplace, and that it is a cost to the companies. Is that conversation happening as to what can be done to, I know you, it's a big problem to change attitudes relating to the hostility that you talked about. But in terms of cost, is there a conversation taking place around that? The teaching staff, not so long ago in many FET colleges, were part-time. People are working elsewhere, in their farmers or whatever the case may be, and they come part-time. And they are not trained teachers, per se. People who are trained. Is that changing such that you, so that you have a stable teaching core at this FET colleges that you can rely on much more than you can with people who come as part-time? The esteem of vocational training, it's very low, as you had indicated, and yet those are the critical people that we need, and they are likely to get employment quicker than those who go through an academic matric and perhaps get an academic degree. Is there something that is being done? I think the chairperson did talk about that it's systemic, it's in the system, that those who seem not to be making it academically are shepherded that way, not in a nice way. But is there something being done to make everyone realize that it is a sexy area of training as well, of education as opposed to this? Honorable James raised the ranking of, if I got it well, about what it means, the relationship between the qualifications that learners get at FET colleges with the university academic activities or qualifications. But I just wanted to check about the portability, just entrance, whether with at what level of FET training can you actually enter a university of technology and proceed. Thank you.
Honorable Mimet Ponchan, Chuan,
just to probably say, do you think we'll have a second bite? Because I feel my quest maker lost in the lot of questions. Because if yes, I'd prefer to go.
No, I think you should respond. You should ask the question, member, because I think some of this she'll direct. It's not necessarily on every little question, but she'll obviously deal with it in a strategic way.
No, thanks, Professor. Well, first to say that the presentation has thrown up quite a number of questions. Yes, quality for all. I remember this, not the previous committee, did visit some colleges, if I remember, last year. What we found that there were still very glaring disparities between those FET colleges that were controlled by and run and administered by the white departments, if I may use that term, and those that were administered by homeless, if I may. And in the presentation, I don't see, I might have missed it, the concentrated effort by the department to bridge these disparities between these FET colleges. And not only that, there were also, and there still exist, some inequalities between the main campus and what they call the satellite of the learning site, especially in rural areas. You know, you drive along the road, you pass this FET college, you just feel that nothing is happening there, or, I mean, the youngsters are just there because they have nowhere else to go. Equipment, it's really, you know, very sadly. That is my question, between the main campus, which is recapitalized, and these learning sites, where there's virtually nothing. What efforts are being put together by the department to bridge that disparity? And lastly, these bursaries. Well, quite a number of cases where bursaries have been, how do I put it, have been awarded to deserving children, but no reasons have been given. And there doesn't seem to be anywhere a student can go to do or to appeal. Because sometimes there was no reason given, having gone through this means test, but to say that your bursary rejected, your application rejected, that's all. And the frustration and everything else. Where can the students go? Did I say lastly?
Final.
It links up to what my colleagues have said already. This structured relationship between the private sector and the FET colleges, and even the government, where the needs of government. You go to China, we will visit China, for instance. These FET colleges don't just produce. There will be a targeted number of, say, engineers, what government needs, you know. But here, that doesn't seem to be the case. I'm not saying we follow that one, but I'm just interested to know whether there is this structured relationship. For sure, Chair, there's no the last one. That was the last one.
No, thank you. Director General, you possibly can see that our members are very, very interested in the subject, because the reality is those would be the beneficiaries of what you've talked about today would be the people that are in our constituencies, predominantly poor, predominantly from working class communities. And therefore, it gives me a sense that it's a very focused area even into the future for our committee. But wisdom will prevail. I think we are comfortable if you deal with things and respond in specifics, but also just give broad strategic directions on it. DG.
Thank you, Chairperson, and thank you to the committee for some very thoughtful questions. What I want to do is to just give a very broad overview whilst the DDG has an opportunity to just make sure that she's processed this very rich range of questions. And I thought it might be useful to come in at the level of this being an activist parliament. It is true that the importance of colleges has been under-recognized and historically in the country. And that is why Member Mangena has said that we need to make sure that we promote the colleges as having the esteem that's appropriate to them, that they're seen as more sexy. And the reason that we need to do that is to respond to the broad question of why are we doing this, why is it important, is the presentation touched on two, well, in fact, three key areas. One, that we have huge challenges in the country of youth unemployment. Talented, intelligent young people who are unable to access opportunities that will enable them to participate in the economy. And one of the reasons that they are unable to put that in the economy is because they don't have the skills for the emerging work opportunities that might be there in the private sector. So the importance of the colleges is that they are going to be providing the skills that are required in the economy, giving opportunities to the poor and the working class to access those skills for participation. The third thing that's very important about the sector is that, as was pointed out, the geographical access with the multi-site notions, even with the weaknesses of some of those sites, means that there's greater accessibility across the country. And Ms. Vingerwald explained that at the moment we're seeing urban drift in relation to young people coming to centres where they perceive to be greater quality, where they perceive that there may be work opportunities. But we, in fact, have an obligation in terms of development across the country to make sure that we have quality in all of those sites. The second important point, I think, for the committee is to understand what is very exciting about the mandate of the new department. It's a department that's been named the Department of Higher Education and Training, but it gives us opportunities which haven't existed in this form before, for us to look at all of the post-secondary opportunities, what happens after school, whether you go into an FET college or university, if you go into work-based learning and access the CETAs. It means that we can look at the system much more inclusively and look at the articulation points, which were raised by several people. There are important articulation points between the colleges and the higher education sector, and there's important articulation points in terms of opportunities that will be driven by the skills framework. So if we look at the key issues that we're addressing here, is the first is access. We've explained why that's necessary, and you have the information in front of you in terms of the huge increase in access that we've seen immediately, as well as what's been planned in the future. But as was stressed in the presentation, when you increase access, there's huge challenges in terms of quality. You can't grow a system as quickly as this without experiencing the need to simultaneously address issues in quality, which have been addressed firstly through the curriculum, secondly in terms of working very hard with potential employers and current employers in terms of workplace learning opportunities, making sure that the colleges maximally run in a way in which the flexibility of the program offerings enable that articulation with workplace. And the relationship with the private sector, I think, is critical with that. Issues of relevance are very important in terms of quality. The other component that was touched on in some of the questions which we need to revisit is the question of institutional building for access and for quality. When individual institutions have to grow in practical terms with increased staff, with new curricula, there's an enormous amount of work that needs to be done in terms of governance and management to support those quality changes. The current legal framework, as the committee is aware, is that we've moved towards much more institutional autonomy. That's put a huge demand on college management and on governance, and we will be looking very carefully at how we can be supporting that. So this massive expansion that we've seen is in line with government program to prioritize education and training to address the challenges that are being faced by the youth. And I think the role of this committee is to support us as we address the challenges of quality, relevance, institution building, and to make sure that as we communicate with young people who are looking for opportunities, that they understand that this is indeed an attractive alternative to other post-secondary options such as higher education. I'll hand over to Didi Kuvenschwald.
Thanks, Didi. Chair, I'm going to try to do some broad things, and then if there's any question that I don't answer, you can write to me and I'll give a written response. Ma'am, this is very embarrassing. We should have said, what do the FET colleges do? So I'm going to start with that. And really the history of our labour market has determined that we haven't had a big middle professional class. When we look at what's happening in Korea, that massive and successful expansion, when we look at developed countries like Germany, for every engineer there will be 6 para-engineers. That's something that people talk about. In South Africa, we don't have that. You go into a construction site now, and you would have your engineer who's been trained at a university or University of Technology, and then you have something called a site foreman and a charge hand. Generally, those people are illiterate. They can't use computers. They can't lay out a drawing. I would say generally, that means that our professionals are unbelievably stretched and stressed. So when people go to other countries, they say, gee, this is such an easy life, because we've never developed that middle band. We've had artisans, skilled artisans, but they've been white and trained in a particular area. We now know that they're 50 plus and moving up. But what we didn't take into account when we started the technical colleges is what are the skills needs of the 21st century. So we're very clear about what we do at APT College. And I talk about our flagship project. That means if you want esteem, if you want to grow with changing technologies, there's a new way of laying out a building or a house. There's a new way of fixing a car. You have to have computers. Computer technology, you have to have language, English, and you have to have mathematics or math literacy. So we say that the students that we produce at an FET college should have both a general education that allows them mobility so that they're not trapped in a particular technology or trapped in a job, which is really what our people were done before. They were those who worked on the mines, those who worked in industries were trapped in a particular job, and they couldn't move. So we want to give them mobility, but we also want to give them good theory and practice so that they can be highly employable and they can be self-employed. And so every one of the 14 programs gives them maths or math literacy, language, and ICT, strong ICT, and then they get some theory and practice. In other words, they work in the workshops. So we wanted to say that by the end, while a small number would go on to higher education, and we agree with Dr. James, there must always be that possibility. The majority of people will go into the workplace, be well paid, or can start their own job. So a small anecdote, when the minister visited his first college, we found that for the first time, NCV students had already started their own businesses. Now, I nearly, as an old auntie, I nearly died of shock when this second-year student said she'd started her own IT business. But what she'd done is that she persuaded her parents in the township to open up another door in the house. And she had bought a computer, a laptop, and she did 3 things. And this is what she called her own company. She taught people to use the computer. She sold internet access, and she did minutes and agendas for the church, the trade teacher union, and so on. She already had an income in her second year. So what we're saying is we're trying to produce the kinds of vocational, second-level professional, not quite the engineer, not quite the person who runs a hotel, but certainly somebody who would be able to walk into a hotel and have worked in a kitchen, knows how the bed and linen and so on work. So, ma'am, I hope I give you a sense of that second-level person. And then all the other questions, Chair, relate to how do we get those new kinds of people? And the perceptions, because it's such a young sector, because we really haven't yet sold to people what these guys do, we will rely on this first cohort of students. There are only 5,000 of them in fourth year that will emerge. And we have asked the National Business Initiative to track them. So every one of those 5,000 will be tracked into the labor market. Do they get a job? How long does it take them to get? What are they paid, and do they work in the sector in which they have been employed? And Chair, it's my view that we need another decade before we will change our perceptions. Even in countries like Britain, who have come to vocational education a little bit later than places like Germany or Korea, those are the only countries that really say it's a really, it's a real option. You leave school and you either go to university or you go into vocational. Sweden, Norway. But we as a country are a long way from changing perceptions. And I'm distressed to hear that there are still teachers and principals in schools that think that this is a dumping ground for those who cannot. That is really bad news for me. Because particularly in the Western Cape, somebody like Kati Kruger, the head of False Bay FET College, he has a breakfast with principals every 2 months in which he invites them onto the site and he explains to them what the new vocational student does. So, Tim, we've got a long way. With your help, we can start to do that. But we also know that there are certainly parental and teacher perceptions that this is a place that gets dumping ground. What we do, in answer to your question, so what do we do, is that we have briefed all our life orientation teachers through their training that FET colleges are colleges of first choice. We talk about it that way. Because before, for life orientation or guidance teachers, it was always the only thing you did when you left matric was you went to university. When you got to standard 6 or 7 and you weren't cutting it, then you could go to a technical college. We have to change that. We have to say you all get your matric. The majority, 80-90% of people get a matric, and then they can choose. So it's a lot of education. You know, the study mates that we hand out every year when we give it to every one of our matric students, the biggest advert is for the NSFAS bursary and for FET colleges. So we've got some way to go, but I think we're making some kind of progress on the perceptions. Perceptions will only change once we improve our throughput. If our college lecturers look like lecturers, are on time, teaching, using textbooks, using high-level technology, we have some way to go in making sure that all of our colleges provide the quality that will also change perceptions about them. And in that respect, in terms of lecturers, Dr. Jane, we have what we call a lecture framework. It's out for public comment at the moment. You might want to look at it. But we're wanting to gear up the college lectures in three aspects. They must have theoretical knowledge of their subject and must be cutting edge. We believe that all college lecturers should have a degree, but that is 5 or 6 year project. We also believe that they should have knowledge of the workplace, and so we would say that there must be an opportunity for them. And here the construction companies, the listed companies, have been very generous. They are giving all our lecturers an opportunity to come into construction companies and upgrade or make sure that they're keeping up to date with what's happening. And then the third, of course, is the pedagogical content knowledge. Do they know how to teach their theoretical knowledge to young people, very diverse, often almost all of them learning in a language that is not their mother tongue. So we say that there are those three aspects that we would want them to sign performance agreements on in relation to quality. And Dr. Jones, we now have a very clear mechanism for measuring their quality because we will publish the results of the NCV Level 4. And it's not true that the Western Cape and Gauteng are the only good colleges. In fact, our chief performers are in Mpumalanga and Limpopo. So the Herzibandi College is the biggest performer. But it is going to be important to show that there are colleges with an 80-90% throughput rate and a pass rate, and then there are colleges with a 20 and lower. So that 30% I'm talking about is an average. And I think we have to go in. We've started to say, and this is why we're looking at Herzibandi and Wembe College, because those two are producing results that go way beyond the socioeconomic background of their students. So we want to learn what they're doing right in that way. Let me then also just say, in terms of relationships with the NYDA, the National Youth Development Agency, we sit on the board of the National Youth Development Agency, Ms. Tembe Sifatshani. She sits there. Chair, they've just started. We're involved with their very first big project, which is a second chance opportunity for those who fail matric. Now, their view is that FET colleges shouldn't be the only one. Some students, the system has let them down, and if they've come close to passing matric, the NYDA is investigating how they can provide 30 or 40,000 students immediately now in January, February, with an opportunity for fast-track tuition if they've just missed it. So we're working with them. And the CETAs, of course, now the CETAs are very friendly to us now that they're going to be under Dublin's funding. So they're coming and knocking on our door all the time. But our colleges work with the CETAs, obviously some more than others. The CETA, the construction, the Merceeta extensively. Some like the Bankseeta we wouldn't work with because they're not in our particular field. But we would certainly, under this administration, want to expand that much tighter, closer working relationship. What do we do about the labor market? You know, this is an interesting thing. Some of the countries I've quoted today do not charge a levy. What they do instead is they require by law companies to take in young people from vocational colleges. And that's much harder than money. You know, it's quite easy for some of our rich companies to give 1%. It's much harder and much more expensive to give people an opportunity. But in Germany, for example, there's no levy. But depending on the size of your company, you have to every year take young people in and give them a highly structured workplace experience. And we think that that is certainly something that we would love to see. Because I'm afraid, Chair, that there are real prejudices amongst our employers. We did a small thing in Pietermaritzburg where we asked 30 construction companies or engineering companies just to take in 2 or 3 people. We had 100 engineering students we wanted to place. We couldn't place them. So we said, look, if you all got together and you each took 3 or 4, the prejudices, they will steal, they will come late, they won't be properly dressed, they will be lazy. At the end of that, once we persuaded them, and at the end of that June 3-week experience, 98 of the 100 were asked to come back and to come and do December work. In other words, those kids changed the perception of, but I'm not denying that this is hard work. These are young people whose parents have often never had formal jobs. In other words, they need time to be inducted. Once they do that, they are wonderful. My own experience in my office of taking kids in to give them an opportunity is that they 3 or 4 weeks is an opportunity to change their lives. Man, the councils, about 5,500 lecturers were employed by the state, and now they've become council employees. But colleges also employed council lecturers who had never been state employees. It's now our job to merge those. Those will all remain under council. Although Minister Nzimande has asked us to look at what is the best employment route to make sure for quality. So we're looking at that for him, and we're having meetings to say what's the best employment opportunity. I think then I'll just end up with the last two, the trading up, the 2-year qualification. Mr. James, we don't at the present have the American Community College. That's quite a bridge for us. If you think of, first of all, our big university sector, but also the schooling system is not yet producing those kinds of learners. What we've just published, and Minister will sign off on it now, is the qualifications that HESA requires to go into degree study, diploma study, and certificate study. So in other words, just like with you going into university with a matric, you have to have certain benchmark cutoffs in order to go into degree study. The possibility is absolutely there. But in the expansion of the colleges, we are looking now to say, how do we take students who want to go into university and generally would not be vocational, and how could we make sure that they could go into third year UWC? But it's not our central focus at the moment. It is that vocational and establishing that band of vocational workers. And then the last one, the illegal colleges, it is our mandate. But we need the law enforcement agencies to help us, and that's why we've brought them into discussions to say, once we've given them a letter indicating that they must cease offering at such and such a time, if they don't appeal, we would want the law enforcement agencies to go in and charge them if they continue beyond that. But you know, there's always good news in all of these stories. In countries where people are very desirous of education, they really want to improve themselves. That's where you get fly-by-night. So it's not always a bad thing. Mm-hmm. You know, other countries have a much bigger private schooling and college system than we do. But when you start to see this vibrancy and the fact that people go to these fly-by-night colleges, it's because they want to improve themselves. Now, we have to make sure that we make that all of those opportunities that open up are quality opportunities. You know, we don't want to go closing down privates or anything like that if they're providing good quality, but it's not a bad sign when there is a market for good products.
Thank you so much for the responses. I see a hand over to you, honourable member.
Just this is not a follow-up in terms of engaging that much. I'm just saying that in as much as it may not be a bad thing and it may be good to legalize them, to actually close down. The problem is that they rig our own people. And beyond that, when these students qualify, they don't necessarily get recognition, you know. Now, it's basically a waste of time. You undergo that training for a year or even 2 years or more, but the next thing, your qualification means nothing. So we can't subject our people to that kind of an... But what we may need to do is to make provision in terms of criteria and all that for those to stick to what government expects of them. And that quality assurance then should be available. If they can't move to that level, then it should be our responsibility to safeguard our people or protect them against such illegal institutions.
Honorable James?
Just a follow up on the 1% levy that finances CETAs. Are you suggesting that you would prefer to have a system whereby companies set aside positions for students on an annual basis in preference to having the 1% levy and the CETA system?
No, we're very greedy. We want both. Yeah. But, you know, Ted, and I go back to the point of, you know, that a large percentage of last year's matriculants were first-time matriculants, and that's a moving thing. Now, these kids come in, and perhaps their parents have worked in a household or on a farm or on a mine. They've not had formal education. I can't tell you what a leap that is into formal education. And we observe with our eyes, and the data shows us that if you have had a workplace opportunity, your chances of getting a job increase. I mean, partly because employers just put that as an obstacle. They say, do you have experience, even though the poor child is 18. And so we say that even a little bit of experience, Dr. James, for these particular children, seems to change their opportunity. So we think it's very important, and that's why we're working so closely with employers. All the 14 programs were designed by industry to make sure we met their needs. And now our job is to say, it's to your advantage. So this is about industry and business in South Africa starting to see that its own future depends on the growth of consumers or the middle class. They cannot narrowly say, next year we're going to need 3 technicians or 3 ICT people. They can't be that narrow. They've got to see that the growth of South Africa and Africa is good for their own business. And I think it's changing that mindset that would make them see that the efforts required in giving young people an opportunity is what they should do.
Thank you. It's a very short question. Thank you, Chairperson of this session. When people go to school, students, they end up being either producers or consumers. Now I'm checking which one of the structures that we're talking about produces more consumers. Now, is it universities or FETs? Because our FETs are supposed to come up with skills. I'm checking so that I never follow up questions.
Yeah, let me try. I think that we're having difficulty with the question because we expect all of our citizens to be producers and to be productive, and also then they're going to be recipients of services and consumers. So maybe we just need an explanation. If you've got a degree and you've come to the higher education system, you will be producing in the workplace, but you'll also be privately purchasing and consuming, or if you have an NCV, or if you have. So maybe you just need clarity to this.
Then my clarity is, you see, the workplace learnership.
Mm.
Once a person is placed there, it's like you have expectations that you'll end up getting a job, but they are students who go there, and at the end of the term, I know for a fact that with prima facie information, you are told that now you wait will talk to you when there is a job. Now, what is it that the Department of Education can do to ensure that once you are placed in that particular situation, you don't end up being disappointed? I mean, you are going there. You actually you are like a volunteer. You're not even paid for what you're doing. And at the end of the day, you don't get this job. Some people come and get a job. I'm checking what can be done to improve that, because this unemployment is a very serious challenge for sure. I'm sure we're aware. And this country holds an ace, and the ace is Department of Education. We don't care. We go and promise jobs. We know we'll do it through the Department of Education. Now, the help part. Thank you.
The Student Support Services, and it's only a year old, Student Support Services framework, we've expected, and we want to make that policy during 2009, that you must have a student support service at each campus. One of the most important things that service does is to look for workplace opportunities, which we believe increases your opportunity, and then to do work placement. So we've been to some colleges where, and you can come to Tshwane South, where they have successfully placed the majority of the NCV level 4 students. We can't guarantee everybody will get a job, but one of the jobs is from now, from June of the last year, is to start looking for jobs and matching young people with jobs.
Honorable members, thanks so much. I personally put two questions to you. I haven't heard them responded to. You see, food is basic. So on food, whether your systems provide food for these destitute people. The second one was around ensuring that those in the rural areas know about these bursary systems. How do we ensure? Because mostly you find them at the universities. I just wanted to add on that, because this is a very concern to me. You're talking about creating a nationally coordinated system of unique identity. You are coaching here students, lecturers. But parents also teach. And a graduate parent produces a graduate student. They have a very important role to play. Recently, in the University of the State, we had incidents of racism. But these young white students, I believe that incident was racially driven. And this from either from the parents or the teachers. So we cannot be leaving the parents. We cannot be leaving them out. We need to comment on them. What did we do in solving the issues of prestige? What will we be doing to stop this recurring in the future? Did we talk to the parents of this particular student, because they groomed them? I believe that we cannot leave that out. The last issue that I want to raise here that is of concern to me is that NSFAS charges unemployed dropout interest. And this increases over time. The rate of unemployment is very, very high. I think it's very much unfair that this should be continued. Maybe the interest must kick in when this particular person is working. How do you respond to that? Thanks.
Chairperson, thank you for those, for reminding us of those four questions. I'm going to try and address them quite quickly so we can move on to the higher education presentation, because I would be very full of regret if we didn't have time to give that justice. If I just can quickly comment, the question of the interest on NSFAS loans is a matter that's on the agenda of the ministerial committee that's been established, and I'm sure when that work is completed and it reports to this committee, we'll be able to engage in more detail. In terms of the efforts made to ensure that young people from rural areas are aware of the FET education opportunities, that work is being taken forward by both the provincial departments in all of the nine provinces and in the network that we have for FET colleges, and I think that in some areas there's students who know that the best, most viable option for them is the local FET college, the one that is accessible. In terms of food, the way that NSFAS operates is that it works on an assessment of the needs of the student relative to the family's ability to provide to those needs. And where we say that the NSFAS bursary covers accommodation, that also means it covers food. So the poorest students are the ones that have access to full cost, including food, because we are concerned that young people who are financially needy should be able to study without anxieties about if they're going to be able to eat. I think that your last question about the role of parents in the attitudes and values and ongoing learning of their children is a very important one. What happens when students enter the post-secondary system is that increasingly we expect them to take greater responsibility for their own conduct, and usually universities and FET colleges would relate much more directly with a student as an adult than they will with parents. But your caution is well noted, that children do continue to be influenced by their parents. As a society, we need to be making sure that all of our citizens accept responsibilities. So we want to thank you for those questions, for the engagement. We look forward to engaging again, but suggest that we move on to higher education.
Thank you, Member Lechetcho. Can I then conclude this session, this first part, by saying, one, that we will have a strategic discussion next week, deep on skills development. I think that's one. And there's knock-on effects. Secondly, that there's quite a few unanswered questions, and I don't think it was accidental. I think it's because there's not proper answers for those things, because there's things that's been grappled with. I, for one, do know that if we ask both national departments and the provinces around what is the supply and demand issues in every province, meaning how many actual, if the economy has grown like that, and obviously there's a little bit of flattening down, and then also you know economic indicators and growth speak to different sectors in different provinces. So you can translate that into the actual number of plumbers, number of engineers, number of artisans, etc., that you'd require. Now, I know those studies are not done. I know surveys have been done, but I know that actual numbers are not there. So that is a glaring omission. Also, even the issue around the best possible FET in the country, which is Limpopo, somewhere in Limpopo, I think it's the average of provincially output.
Yeah.
It's not necessary. The reference did not relate to the actual, because there's in poor provinces possibly one or two FET colleges, and they can't sustain that. So it's not which one was the best. It was on average provincially based what we are getting. I think that's the distinction that I've drawn. Otherwise, we are falling into a trap that says, great, it's in the Limpopo, but if you're actually starting to look at the numbers of the populace, the young people there, and the actual number of FET colleges, then it's a complete distortion. Also, as I came in, you mentioned, DDG, the issue of 5,000. Is it 5,000 from January next year? That's getting out of the system.
In the
end of, sorry, that's getting out of the system. I think we would want a particular presentation on that 5,000, not necessarily for next week, but say in October, so that there's enough space to meet the different departments related. What's going to happen with those 5,000? What is the bracket in terms of the various sectors that they're involved with? So 500 is involved with that, another 500 is that. And what is the actual placement processes that's happening? Now, I know that doesn't mean in terms of your core responsibility, but whoever is responsible needs to come to it, but you would be our link because this is our portfolio. Also, the issue around the... You get this at FET colleges. I'm many times surprised by the money that... What is the FET? Just a question. The FET, the FET budget in this country, what is it?
It's
over $3 billion. We tend to look at the place, kind of the opportunity for the beneficiary to get into the system, but I'm actually also interested. If we speak about the opportunity beyond studies, what is the supply opportunity at all of these FET colleges? And how many of the young people that is actually becoming events managers, caterers, et cetera, how many of them are linked to the supply opportunity of those FET colleges? And I think, so it is how we speak as departments to one another. I think there's a lot of fragmentation. So as we are getting, because we speak, if we are dealing with the beyond the studies, the first port of call, in a sense, for me would be, of some of those students, is how you capture them into the opportunities that the FET sector would provide. Whether it is the capital infrastructure extensions, how are they being linked to some of those programs? So that's where we're going to go to in the future. It's that knock-on effect, and I would want to just sensitize you that that's possibly an area. We appreciate the link with the YDA because I think that's vital, because the YDA has got this responsibility in terms of its mandate. Let's leave it there. If there's any questions that we feel that we need, most probably further, you've committed yourself, I think, in the beginning on a report for tomorrow, but I think we can say Monday, so it gives a little bit of more space. The status, yeah. Remember, you started off there. And then there's the skill development discussion next week, as well as the October process relating to what practically happens for those students beyond December. And we would not be interested in the kind of broad analysis, but in the technical detail. If you would want to ask, in fact, we can possibly write a letter just to say these are the actual specifics that we would be interested in. So, DJ, over to you on the second part of this business session.
The purpose of this presentation is to focus our minds on the planning initiatives within the Department of Education, the higher education sector. We have derived from the white paper multiple lenses to view higher education planning. These multiple lenses are as follows and guide and serve as our guiding principles in terms of planning for the sector. That is improved access to higher education, looking specifically at students from poor and marginalized communities, looking at affordability, looking at access from a very broadened definition of access. The responsiveness of higher education to the social and economic development priorities of the country. Improvement in terms of research and innovation. Quality of the academic programs and the quality of student life, as well as the redress of historical inequalities in the system. And these broadly have shaped the planning parameters for higher education. In terms of our policy goals, the current state of higher education is based on performance indicators which are in turn derived from our higher education policy goals. We have 12 goals from the white paper, and 6 from the National Plan for Higher Education. Just broadly, the policy goals of the size and shape of the higher education system, what does that look like in terms of entry to higher education, the kinds of programs that are offered, enrollments in particular areas like science and technology, business and management, as well as our postgraduate production. It also looks at student equity in terms of our participation as well as success of the students in the system, staff equity at our institutions, participation of our women in the system's higher education institutions, academic staff inputs, the relationship between qualified staff at our institutions in turn in relation to particular programs and qualifications that are offered at these institutions, teaching outputs from the system, how to improve our success rates, the production of graduates, and then a finer grained goal in terms of graduate output in the fields of science and technology as well as business and management. In terms of research outputs, one of the performance indicators is the improvement of output in terms of master's and doctoral students and research output as well. And the last goal, which is quite critical and which in a sense links both the funding formula for higher education quite closely to our current review of the National Student Financial Aid Scheme and links back into our primary goal of access and equity and success. In ensuring that the goal of access and the affordability aspects are looked at quite closely. In terms of our planning processes, in 2006, the department initiated the first student enrollment planning process for the period 2006 to 2010. In 2009, we are about to commence a new cycle for the period from 2011 onwards to 2016. And it is quite important at this point for us to stop and review the data of all our institutions, both at the institutional level and then at the national level. We are currently in the process of reviewing and creating institutional profiles for each institution, taking into account what the previous enrollment targets were set for these institutions. And the question is, what should the planning parameters include in our new cycle of enrollment planning? How does the HE system contribute to national human resource development and our research priorities? How to pay attention to the need on one hand to increase enrollment and graduate output of scarce and critical skills, matching, quite importantly, enrollments to available resources, physical, human, and financial, institutions to focus on improving teaching and learning to ensure that the improvement of teaching and learning has a knock-on effect in terms of graduation and success rates. We also need to adopt quite a differentiated approach to enrollment planning, and the reason for this differentiated approach to enrollment planning is based on a number of variables. Some of these range from the capacity of our institutions in terms of actual physical space, in terms of laboratory equipment, in terms of academic staff capacity, in terms of their niche areas, in terms of programs, qualifications that they offer, in terms of their location as well. The process that we will be following is fivefold. We will be looking at plans and proposals from each institution.
So it's not a top-down approach. It's an iterative process where we provide institutions with their institutional profiles, looking at what institutions are doing, what are they planning for, and how best we can accommodate them within the context of the overall national planning targets. Institutions have the responsibility to evaluate their growth possibilities, taking into account multiple factors like infrastructure capacity, staff-student ratios, etc. Institution-specific output-input targets are then approved by the minister. The targets, in turn, then determine the level of government funding available for each institution. And as a further performance measure, the council of every institution is then asked to accept the targets as well as to initiate a process of close monitoring of the institution's progress in relation to these targets. This is a very broad overview of what the sector looks like right now in terms of headcount enrollments, that is actual heads on campus. If you look at the growth, we have as of 2007 hit approximately 761,000 in 2007. In 2008, I would say that the data is still coming in because it requires auditing, and we still are awaiting about four institutions' data in order to get a definitive figure for 2008, but it's not much more than the 761. 2009 data suggests that we are still sitting under the 800,000 mark. The target at the moment is to achieve 816 by the year 2010. In order for us to achieve our overall participation rate of 20%, this would require a total enrollment of about 920,000 students in the system.
Why 816 and not 820?
It was based on a 2% growth per year, and based also on capacity of the system, based on space data, actual physical infrastructure.
Present in documents, this is different, so it will get there.
Government funding of higher education has to go hand in hand with growth of students in the system, and this is something that we have to monitor quite closely. At the moment, you will see that we have block grants, which are the grants given in terms of student enrollments. We have earmarked grants, which are specific grants allocated to institutions for particular purposes. So, for example, we have infrastructure and efficiency grants, which institutions are required to put in proposals. The proposals for expansion, just in terms of infrastructure, have to match the institution's actual program and qualification profile, as well as the kinds of students that they take in, as well as the needs of the institution in terms of actual physical space. The plans also have to factor in that if you, for example, increase capacity in laboratories, you've also got to increase capacity in terms of actual human resources to match the growth in space, and to take into account what your enrollment targets could be in terms of the data that you've provided. The challenges that currently confront us: low student success rates, low student throughput rates, higher staff-student ratios. How do we ensure that we improve teaching and learning within our institutions in order to achieve higher success rates as well as higher throughput rates, lower research productivity, and what can be done through the funding formula in order to incentivize or provide actual financial assistance for our institutions to assist researchers in producing research, inadequate academic infrastructure. The last major space audit of our institutions was in 2005, and that space audit indicated that we were full to capacity at all our campuses in terms of actual space for students to be in terms of laboratories, lecture theatres, libraries. We've just been receiving the latest space data from our institutions, and this space data will be matched in this year against the enrollments at our institutions in particular fields to see what our capacity is, carrying capacity is currently in the system. Increasingly, and it's featured, it features every year at the beginning of the year, is the demand, the high demand for student residences. We have just sent out in the last month a questionnaire to all our institutions to try and assess what the demand is for student residences and what the capacity is within particular institutions for residences. Institutions have two types of residences at the moment. They have their own residences, but in response to the high demand for accommodation by our students, they are entering into private public partnerships with other partners in order to provide more accommodation. But from the NISFAS review, we've already identified this is a problematic area because the cost of a private public partnership residence is far more than the actual residence cost of a public institution. And so a student receiving a loan or who could be classified as financially needy would really need to be accommodated within the university's own residences. And this is already proving to be something that needs to be explored at greater length. We have, of course, as has been quite clear, an increased demand for financial aid. Chairperson, I trust that at some point you will call us in to discuss some of the findings of the NISFAS Ministerial Committee. But we have, over the last few weeks, engaged with almost all higher education institutions, barring the Western Province, which takes place next week. So that's the only province that has not been engaged with. We've met with 17 public institutions, higher education institutions, all the FET colleges, consulted with senior management, with deans of students, with financial aid officers, with the Association for Financial Aid Officers. We've also consulted both at the national level with the students, but also at each institution with the student leadership. And this is an area, the area of financial need is something that we still have to get our heads around because it's very interlinked. And it's interlinked with the funding formula for higher education. It's linked to the actual cost of study at our higher education institutions. It's also linked to how do we calculate the actual cost of study at an institution. And how do we ensure that our students who are given financial aid, that if you provide the student fees, what does one do in terms of their transport requirements for books, requirements for in certain programs and qualifications for certain equipment, which is very highly specialized. And so the issue of financial aid is one that is actually multi-layered, and it almost feels like you I think it's called the Chinese box. But, you know, you open up one and you immediately have 10 other little problems popping up. And, you know, you think you've cracked one problem and you immediately see that there are major issues. But in terms of our expansion of our system, we have commissioned studies based on our population statistics and our population data, the October survey that will come out from Stats South Africa, in order to project what is our financial need going to be. At the moment, we have 130,000 students across the different first year, second year, third year, with financial aid bursaries of different levels of financial aid. So this is something which is going to be a real challenge and might need almost a slide of its own. the key consideration for enrollment planning, it's quite absolutely critical that to evaluate the capacity of our current institutions in terms of infrastructure. At the beginning of this year, you would have heard that enrollments, as enrollments were happening at the beginning of the year, you would find that even institutions like Fitz University use the Great Hall for some of the lectures because, you know, lecture theatres weren't sufficient, especially for big enrollment courses like economics and English. And this is something that we have to take into account as we expand. What is the actual carrying capacity of a lecture theatre in relation to the enrollments for specific courses? What is the growth in terms of our traditional universities? We have 11 of them. Our comprehensive institutions, which offer a combination of diploma and degree courses, we have 6 of them. And our universities of technology, plus 2 national higher education institutes, one in Mpumalanga and one in Kimberley. What is the growth and how will they grow and what should their shape be? And the shape, of course, has to be within layers of whether it's undergraduate, whether it's postgraduate, whether the growth takes place in terms of science and technology courses, whether the growth should be in the humanities or the business. And each institution has to be evaluated in terms of its current capacity and what is the possibility or the potential for it to actually grow, because unplanned growth, not just in terms of infrastructure, can actually create a new problem of having a blockage in the system if you don't have the adequate staff and support structures to ensure that our staff-student ratios are adequate, but it's not just at the broader level of staff-student ratios, but it's actually about staff being qualified to teach as per the requirements of specific qualifications. Other areas to be considered are the identification of what are the strategic levers to increase access, graduation rates, success rates at all levels of study, how to ensure that planning, funding, and quality all meet at some point without and are equally weighted, as well as what are the resourcing requirements of the sector. In relation to the last one, we commissioned and had a joint task team with Treasury. And we submitted a report to Treasury last year looking at the cost of production of a graduate for the country at the diploma level, at a certificate level, at the degree level, at the postgraduate level, and what would be the resourcing requirements of the higher education sector should it try to grow in particular ways. And this study is still at Treasury, and we haven't had a response to it, but there is some very interesting data in that study which alludes to a real need for us to revisit the way in which funding is allocated to higher education, and also to look at the way in which the funding formula is allocated to institutions if we are to grow in a particular direction. Some of the broad parameters in terms of our headcount growth to achieve a headcount target of 820, we need 82,000 more students than 2005. We've got an annual growth of approximately, on average, 2.1. In some years, it's been 2%. Our shape and size, we determined in terms of the national plan, data which said 30% of our student enrollment should be in science, education, and technology, 30% should be in business and management, 40% in humanities. This is at a very broad level. If you look quite fine-grained in terms of what are the qualifications that our students are emerging with, that is actually the real question in terms of the students' employability within the broader market.
So does this 20,000 refer to a different target than the 82,000?
Yes, it's probably just in terms of teaching input units, but the target has been 820.
Okay. I didn't remember this, David. Yeah, right through the presentation, okay. Because it's 4,000 different.
In terms of our student outputs, the average success rates have to improve from 71%. To at least 77%, which then in turn will increase our current graduates from 120,000 approximately per year to 150,000. To increase our enrollments and graduates both at the master's and doctoral level, and to ensure that even though we are talking about increasing enrollments at the master's and doctoral levels, to also have the supervisory capacity within our institutions in order to increase these graduation rates at this level, to increase our participation rate, which is sitting somewhere at 16.5 right now, to 17.5 in 2010. And the final participation rate that has been agreed on in the national plan was 20% by 2014. The following slide is illustrative of our attempts to grow the number of students and enrollments in terms of science, engineering, and technology, business, education, and other humanities. You will see that there is an upward trend. You will see a dip in 2006 with education, a dip in 2005 for business, and then once again, we seem to be more or less on target in terms of growing the system towards attainment of our 30% of our enrollments being in science and 30% in business and the balance in humanities. These are updated until 2008. The 2008 data, of course, as I've indicated earlier, has four institutions whose data is still to be, the data is included, but the data has to still get the auditor's approval. But it is more or less accurate. The same applies in terms of graduates by field of study. You will see that our highest producer is currently in the field of science, engineering, and technology, where we have a gentle growth, especially between 2005 to 2008, And most of our initiatives in terms of foundation programs, teaching development grants, have been geared towards the area of science education and technology in order to ensure that there is an improvement in teaching and learning. I've referred to these. What are the strategic interventions that we can take on right now? And I thought I'd refer to some of the more important initiatives that are taking place within our institutions. It's quite clear that enrollments have to be linked to our resources, that our institutions in turn have to focus on improving graduation and success rates, that we need a differentiated approach to enrollment planning, taking into account context of institution, mission of institution, as well as set goals and targets. At the moment, what we have been doing is allocating infrastructure money for capital projects at our institutions. To just give you an example illustratively, the University of the Western Cape has been allocated $200 million for life sciences and laboratories. This is quite important because the Western Cape is one of the big producers of science graduates for our country. The University of Johannesburg, to develop the Soweto campus beyond what it is currently at. We've allocated $300 million to them in this last financial cycle to ensure that our students' facilities, both in terms of lab facilities, in terms of the library, in terms of computer access, are improved. UKZN has recently been allocated a further $150 million to once again improve the biological sciences on the Westville campus. We have the University of Venda, one of our rural institutions, that has not had proper capital injection for a long time, but since 2006, we have allocated 400 million rands to the University of Venda to improve accommodation, lecture theatres, accommodation for students, as well as computer facilities, as well as a disabled students unit. Walter Sisulu has received a major injection of 450 million rands in order to improve the creation of a science techno park in the East London area, as well as to develop the health sciences facility in the Mthatha area. We also have Fort Hare University with 180 million for development of the East London campus. These are some of the just illustrations of the way in which our infrastructure funding is linked in to planning for particular institutions and in order for them to then begin to project their planned growth in those particular areas. So we have in this last round of infrastructure funding that we had a strong focus on health sciences and the other sciences, engineering sciences, the built environment, and teacher education. But one of the areas that was clearly something that we needed to pay attention to was the renovation and building of student residences as a matter of urgency and priority. In fact, the number of bids that came into the department for the building of residences far exceeded the amount of money that the department had available. Other strategic interventions that we've had, which are quite important and feature in terms of academic thinking conceptually about our academic programs, the intake of our students, what is the quality of our intake, and what is it that institutions can do in order to ensure that there is success at the end of the year. We've had the foundation provision grant, for which institutions have been able to apply for foundation grants from the department in specific areas of management, business, accounting, and the sciences as well. And this is to ensure that it does provide some avenue of access for students who might be underprepared. So you have the foundation grants, and then you have the focus on the teaching development grant, which is to improve the institutional student success rates. Other strategic interventions that have been there is regulating the private higher education sector, enhancing our higher education management information system, as well as opportunities for internationalization of HE and responding to HIV/AIDS. There are several others that are on the table and in the pipeline at different stages of implementation, like the new higher education communications framework, the very obvious need for us to establish a national information and application service, which is emerging also as the finding from the National Student Financial Aid Scheme, that students need to know whether they will qualify for financial aid should they be given a place at an institution. And lastly, to increase the diversity of post-school options and work together with the Higher Education Quality Committee in improving the quality of our graduates and the programs at our institutions.
Thank you. Again, I really must commend the department for the type of presentation, because it does give the technical details. I'm noting a few hands. Now, what I am going to suggest is that this meeting will finish at 12:30. That's one. So I'm going to ask people just to ask the question, and we then will have responses, and then we'll summarize. But I have to say that the presentation, the first presentation, is something that we are moving into the future with that information. We did not yet necessarily focus too much on the FETs up till now, because we first wanted to deal with what higher education did in the past as a department. So in its first enrollment issues, a range of these things we've actually discussed. So the presentation comes nicely in a sense at the end of a month focus on the higher education arena. So I want members to keep that in mind. Doesn't mean that there's not a lot of engagement that we can do on that, because we did meet the various institutions as well. And the good one of this is you're summarizing now the strategic elements out of each of that. So I'm noting the ends, and I'll do what I normally do. I'll start just go around. So it seems to me member at the end really wants hers to be first so that it's not dropped off the list. Okay, fine. Let's start with you.
Okay, now we'll start there. And then I'll go to you.
Thank you, Chairman. I know you want short and I'll try, but if there was anything I needed to come to Parliament and say, for me, is what I want to say now. And please, you can cite me forever after this.
No problem.
Thank you so much for a wonderful presentation. Can I just say, probably just take my gloves off for a moment and talk to the system of education, not talk to anyone, but just voice that kind of locked up emotion I've had all the time with education. Heavy, coming from that as well, but also coming from a private sector now for 10 years. And there being this whole interaction and interrelationship or lack of between higher education and industry, or economy, if you like. And I'm sitting here and I'm trying to be all sorts of things. I'm trying to be an educationist, but I'm also trying to represent that which education is preparing the students for. And there's something I am not hearing, and this is my frustration with the system. For me, language itself is a facilitator, but it can also be a barrier, it can also be a frontier. It carries the message of your own intention. And I'm sitting here and I am listening. And of course, I know that this presentation is to look particularly at the planning for education. But I'm sitting here and I'm almost asking the question, preparing for what? I see that there's some kind of issue, like some kind of paralysis around the product itself. But for me, there is no interrelationship between the product and the market. And this is my frustration. So my issue here is that if you speak the language of the economy that you want to be part of, or you speak the language of the economy that you want to influence or engage, then speak that language, because then it hears you. If education is there to break the cycle of poverty and it is meant to facilitate participation in the economy. I would like to persuade that if we are saying responsiveness of higher education to economic and social development priorities of the country, I agree with that. Because any economy will tell you about that, but there's more to it. Economy today speaks of sustainability. And you cannot finish what you intend to do if you do not use the triple bottom line accounting. In other words, you are going to have your economic, you'll have your social, but you also have your environmental priorities. Because when you speak about those priorities, you're speaking both green and brown issues of environment. Because now you are talking about generational issues going forward. So I want to persuade the department to cast the net wider from social to economic to include environmental priorities as an issue of sustainability. This is the language of economy, today, tomorrow, and forever. And the other one, I am listening and I'm saying, whose language are you speaking? Your language, which you understand well, but who are you persuading to come into the relationship with you? It's the other people. By economy, by the way, we're speaking a much wider, you know, kind of stakeholder base. But also in education, what race are we running? What is the race? Do we have in the mix the 100-meter race? Do we have the relay? Do we have the marathon? What is the offering out there so that at any point in time, we keep in touch with the economy itself? And also out there, we're speaking of citizenship. For me, curriculum is the product of what we're trying to do. And obviously, in getting learners into the system, we're creating citizens. So I'm just also wanting to persuade education to look into the issue of citizenship, to say what kind of a citizen are we trying to produce as the education of South Africa? Because the nation out there in the economy is waiting for this kind of a citizen. And this is the developmental question for me in the sphere of education and what we are trying to. So that really is that. I just want us to listen to our language and listen to who is listening to us, so that we're not perfect in our own language and understanding of ourselves without actually understanding that the market for which we are reading the students are understanding what our language is. Because then, because of this, there's always been this disconnect between the economy and education, because nobody is listening nor hearing the other, because no one is speaking the language of the other. Thank you.
I just had a very quick comment and then a question. The comment is that I reviewed together with somebody called Michael Kahn and the vice chancellors of all the four universities based in the Western Cape reviewed their scientific publications. And a very interesting pattern that emerged from that is that the highest, in terms of sheer quantum of publications by field, was in biochemistry. All four. The second highest was in disciplines associated with health, so from immunology to surgery, and so on. And that reflects a concentration in the Western Cape of the fact that we have two medical schools, two big public hospitals, teaching hospitals. We have a dentistry school at UWC, and so on. And what it also suggested was an opportunity to do things in the area of plant pathology, one of the areas that you were focusing on in terms of plant health and also animal health,
which has been largely concentrated in Pretoria and in Gauteng and so on. But the fact that in the Western Cape there is a coast, and so conservation marine biology is clearly a must in terms of further years. So just by way of saying that, you're obviously spot on in terms of your approach to it, because a life sciences building at UWC, which is a magnificent building going up to completion, is a testimony to that kind of growth. So that's my comment. If you like to have a copy of that presentation, which also, this is Michael Kahn's presentation, which also looks at collaboration between the four universities and the Medical Research Council, the Agricultural Research Council when it comes to food work, food security and so on. You're welcome to have that. My question had to do with universities of technology. Now, in terms of global best practice, any university that calls itself a university of technology is a science university, because science is the incubator for technologies. And they must offer core areas of study, otherwise I don't know what the graduates would look like. You must offer mathematics, you must offer chemistry, you must offer biology, you must offer biophysics, and you should be able to offer clearly engineering. Anything else is an add-on. Geology is an add-on, astrophysics is an add-on, and so on and so forth. And presently, our University of Technology do not do that. I mean, the Cape University of Peninsula University does not offer biology, and so on. So it's, I think there ought to be a focus, it's a question. There ought to be a focus to drive the undergraduate University of Technology in the science direction in a much more coherent way. And one can specialize, you know, the University of Technology in rural areas can deal with questions of animal health and agriculture and so on. So that is my question.
Well, thank you very much. I also congratulate you on your presentation. In my previous life, I was alarmed by the number of academics and professors and so on who would like to leave academic life or who have left, and they are applying to all sorts of places for positions. So there is a one-way street from the universities to government departments, science councils, and of course the private sector. And there is no circulation, it doesn't go back. Meaning this road, it doesn't go back to the universities. People don't leave from councils or government and so on. And this is because the conditions of service and particularly salaries are not harmonized. If you look at your slide number seven, that talks to challenges for success, low student success rates, low student throughput rates, higher staff student ratios, lower research productivity. All these challenges will not be resolved until you attend to that matter. Because the more you increase the number of students and the more lecturers and professors leave universities, the more the conditions are difficult. And so your success rates, your throughput rates, and so on, and research is not going to improve because the teaching loads are very high, and so lecturers, especially the junior ones, are not able to do any research at all. From where you are sitting now, is something happening? Can you see something? Some light at the end of the tunnel, that conditions of service and salaries will be harmonized so that we can see a circulation, people moving around in the system, not a one-way situation. The production, that's the number two, is the production of masters and doctoral students. Of course, it's also related to the first question that I raised. You need a lot of academics, senior academics, to supervise these junior ones. There is a view that if you want to see more students doing master's and doctoral studies, we're going to increase the grants so that working class students are also, or students from working class communities are also able to do doctoral or master's degrees. Presently, a lot of them are under pressure. Immediately after finishing the first degree, to go and work and support the family. They can't afford to go and sit at a university and do a master's and doctoral. Is there a possibility that those grants can be increased substantially, maybe through the NRS or so, so that more working class students are able to pursue senior degrees?
We've got 5 minutes left for responses, so I'm still noting in. So I've tried to suggest that we should be specific. I mean, it was not a reference to the last speaker, because in fact it was possibly the first two speakers on this, but Member Bukaza has indicated that there is the just saying it and really raising the issue, because there's a there was a concern on these things. I'm noting, Mishwana.
Okay, thanks. And I won't disappoint you, Chairperson, because I want to comment that the Department of Education has a plan. Anybody with a plan, for sure, aims to succeed. And I'm concerned that you submitted a report last year, and it's now September, and there is no response yet. That's what I picked up. And I'm concerned that perhaps in future, the advice is that you need to give time frames, because you cannot give a report which should get we keep on blaming Department of Education, but there are people who are not responding when they are given a report. And I from me you get an A. Thank you.
I can appreciate it if we can get maybe the breakdown of the participation in this higher education as per race, gender, just to see, because I just want to look at where do we lose our students. We've been talking of the FET, where the perception is not yet much. People don't want to get in there. Do we have them in the higher education? What is the breakdown of according to race, gender, and also the disabled? Do we have people living with disability who are getting in there? I was happy because in one of the institutions, you talk of the money that has been popped up to make sure that the structure as a whole does cater for such people. And again, if maybe next time, because I know the time, we don't have time on our side, the outputs versus the demands, like what to regulate the programs offered. Maybe I will talk more especially on the field that I'm in again. Education, like, do we get the programs that are being offered in these institutions? Do they respond to what is needed outside there? Or do we get graduates, as to say we have a higher number of graduates, people have graduated, but really they don't fit in the demands that are needed down there? What regulation do we have in the different institutions of what is being offered there? Thank you.
Yeah, can you get some responses?
I'm going to try and be quite quick. Just in terms of the first question, I think it's quite important that we have a connect between our universities in terms of their fitness for purpose, fitness of purpose, and their linkage with the broader economy and society, as well as in terms of what is it that they are offering, where are the students going out finally, and what kinds of students are we producing? Because we have a lot of focus on the quantitative, you know, how many graduates do we produce, what fields are we producing in, but it is a question of what kind of a graduate. And I'm quite happy to note that several institutions have been beginning these conversations on what is it that the graduate of a particular institution, beyond the knowledge and the applied competence to perform his task or her task, what exactly is this graduate's contribution to the broader society going to be? Dr. James, in terms of, I'd really like to have a look at that paper by Michael Kahn and yourself, but in terms of the UOTs, we have a problem that we have to try and manage quite carefully, in that the universities of technology have been suffering from some kind of academic drift, where, in a sense, they've been moving away from the mandate of being universities of technology, you know, into increasing enrollments in education or the humanities or sort of the softer skill technology courses. And this is something which there is an initiative, the South African Technology Network, where five of our UOTs belong, and they've set up a series of performance indicators to try and grapple with the very important issue of the one that you raised. What percentage of their courses and programs should be in the field of science and technology in order for them to actually be true to the mandate of being called a university of technology? Mm-hmm. Because you can't carry that title if you are drifting elsewhere, and you might cease to be a UOT then. In terms of research development and our academic staff, our institutions have autonomy. We do not control salaries at our institutions, so it's very hard to talk about conditions of service for the academics, but retention of our academics is something that our universities, through bodies such as HESA, that one has to take up, because increasingly we are finding, for example, there are some courses, if one talks at the units of our qualifications, there are some courses like economics, first year history, English, political science, physics, where the numbers, as much as we are enrolling, the numbers are so high that it's actually almost physically impossible for one lecturer to be actually marking. So the issue of retention of academic staff is something which our institutions need to take on quite seriously. Some of our institutions, at least amongst the traditional institutions, have begun offering incentives to our master's and doctoral students, full stipends and full cost of study paid for production of the students. This is, of course, an area that we have been working in cooperation with the NRF to ensure that we do look at financial aid for our master's and doctoral students. The NISFAS review is also looking at the possibility, whether there is a possibility. In terms of the response from Treasury, we just had a very unfortunate turnover in staff in terms of this. Racial breakdown of our graduates and our entrants, we can produce, and we have that available. I thought it had been presented earlier, so I excluded the slide for today. Program regulation is a combination of internal and external regulation. Internal regulation by universities themselves through the Senate, external regulation through bodies such as the Higher Education Quality Committee for the quality aspect, and in terms of the Department of Education, in terms of ensuring that qualifications that are offered fit within the program qualification profile of the institution. I think I've answered all the questions.
Except for the issue of triple of bottom line.
Yes.
And I think we hear your passion, and I think it will be an interesting challenge for the sector. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Let me say that we, as I've indicated, the month of August, we've actually dealt with a range of higher education matters. We visited NSFAS offices. We invited HESA to our building. and now we've had this presentation. Clearly, if we are saying the presentation has been thought through, it therefore does not mean that in the conclusion of this discussion we necessarily completely satisfied with some of the critical issues, which I do not believe it is at the level of yourselves at times. For one, if you look at this, I think you mentioned the 30% is that scarce-skilled field, right? The, 30% in that scarce-skilled field. Now, if you actually look at every municipality in this country, that at least close to a third of municipalities do not have the technical skill. I think it's roughly 80 municipalities. So they don't have a head of the technical field, which is an engineer, for example, or a qualified technical person. And so there is that problem. Then at the level of public works departments or transport departments, you will have a 33% to 35% or even at times 40% vacancy rate at that level. So this where you've got the 30% input and that access doesn't mean it is the throughput, but whatever you get through, where do they go to? And I've indicated the committee at some stage that 200 professional engineers came into our system in 2000 and 200 left that same year the country. So it was the experienced ones that left, it was the graduates, young graduates that came into the system. So somehow there is an area, I kind of, if I look at, for example, the slide of projection, I'm wondering at times if this slide that was there the last few years, meaning it's planning as the department has planned, or was there a moment where this new government has said, but we need a renewed focus on education, and we're not happy with the type of outputs that we had in the past or outcomes. And what, therefore, is that change? So that we're just not doing what I would call business as usual stuff. And I must admit, at some stage, I feel the planning is mediocre, the interventions are mediocre. It is not, and it's not it's not your portfolio necessarily alone. It is just the implication of a decision in Parliament and the President's pronouncement on education, and the effect on that. So there's an area there that I would be interested. We are asking, and the committee, I've noted the committee over the last month and a half, asking probing questions on very particular issues. And we're not getting what we are looking for. And I think it relates to that catch-22, and how do we get out of that? How do we move beyond where we are? And that's something, DJ, that one would be interested to get at some stage, the department to come back to us, most probably because the department is busy with its repositioning process. But at some stage, we have to come back. If we've made a judgment on the last 50 years on education, and in particular even over the last 10, 15 years, how do we get out of that spin? And that's the issue that I'm interested in. We also didn't hear the question around community, but I don't need an answer for now on community service as people come out of the system in education. And where do they get to? That's the point around municipalities that I've referred to earlier, but that's not a response that I'm looking for. Gigi, it seems to me you wanted just to respond on the general comment.
Yes, thank you very much, Chairperson. I think as we continue to engage each other, one of the things that's going to be a challenge for both the Portfolio Committee and the Department is to take a perspective that's long-term in terms of higher education. I think that our planning frameworks tend to give us a five-year horizon, but in fact we need to understand that planning in the sector is a 20-year horizon and longer. It might be useful for the Portfolio Committee to receive a report on the Human Resource Development Strategy for South Africa because this is going to be providing an overall framework for higher education, for the seekers, for FET. And we'll see there that the planning frameworks are indeed long-term as well as short-term. So in order to get the long-term outcomes that we need in terms of both quantity and quality, we need to take that perspective.
Thank you. I think that reinforces our view. We've discussed it in the committee. We said we need a 30-year planning cycle when it comes to education. So I think we do agree with a long-term approach to it. With that, members, we'll then be seeing the department next Tuesday, next Wednesday, but it will be on the back of skills development.
Yeah.
Thanks a lot, DJ. Thanks a lot, presenters.
You mean the minister of the last?
Yeah.
No, we'll do it at the next.
Give me the public. Okay, with that, I
I'm not even a man. No, I'm not even a man. 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 I'm not even a man.